Your return exactly offsets the fact that every dollar in your portfolio has lost 10% of its purchasing power, a point lost on Uncle Sam. You owe taxes on your 10% gain. Taxes are unpleasant when you've made money. They really stink when you haven't. Having said all that, moderate inflation, were it a constant or predictable rate, would have very little effect. Suppose, for example, that we knew the inflation rate would be 10% a year forever, no higher, no lower. We could deal with that easily. Any savings account would pay some real rate of interest plus 10% to compensate for inflation. Our salaries would go up 10% a year. Plus, we'd hope, some additional sum based on merit. All loan agreements would charge some real rental rate for capital plus a 10% annual premium to account for the fact that the dollars you're borrowing are not the same as the dollars you'll be paying back. Government benefits would be indexed for inflation, and so would taxes. But inflation is not constant or predictable. Indeed, the aura of uncertainty is one of its most insidious costs. Individuals and firms are forced to guess about future prices when they make economic decisions. When the auto workers and Ford negotiate a 4-year contract, both sides must make some estimates about future inflation. A contract with annual raises of 4% is very generous when the inflation rate is 1%, but a lousy deal for workers if the inflation rate climbs to 10%. Lenders must make a similar calculation. Lending someone money for 30 years at a fixed rate of interest carries a huge risk in an inflationary environment. So when lenders fear future inflation, they build in a buffer. The greater the fear of inflation, the bigger the buffer. On the other hand, if a central bank proves that it's serious about preventing inflation, then the buffer gets smaller. One of the most significant benefits of the persistent low inflation of the 1990s was that lenders became less fearful of future inflation. As a result, long-term interest rates dropped sharply, making homes and other big purchases more affordable. Robert Barrow, a Harvard economist who studied economic growth in nearly 100 countries over several decades, has confirmed that significant inflation is associated with slower real GDP growth. It seems obvious enough that governments and central banks would make fighting inflation a priority. Even if they made honest mistakes trying to drive their economies at the speed limit, we'd expect small bursts of inflation, not prolonged periods of rising prices, let alone hyperinflation. Yet that is not what we observe. Governments, rich and poor alike, have driven their economies not just faster than the speed limit, but at engine-smoking, wheel-screeching kinds of speeds. Why? Because short-sighted, corrupt, or desperate governments can buy themselves some time by stoking inflation. We spoke about the power of incentives all the way back in Chapter 2. Still, see if you can piece this puzzle together. 1. Governments often owe large debts, and troubled governments owe even more. 2. Inflation is good for debtors because it erodes the value of the money they must pay back. 3. Governments control the inflation rate. Add it up. Governments can cut their own debts by pulling the inflation ripcord. Of course, this creates all kinds of victims. Those who lent the government money are paid back the face value of the debt, but in a currency that's lost value. Meanwhile, those holding currency are punished because their money now buys much less. And last, even future citizens are punished because this government will find it difficult or impossible to borrow at reasonable interest rates again, though bankers do show an odd proclivity to make the same mistakes over and over again. Governments can also benefit in the short run from what economists refer to as the inflation tax. Suppose you're running a government that's unable to raise taxes through conventional means, either because the infrastructure necessary to collect taxes does not exist, or because your citizens cannot or will not pay more. Yet, you have government workers, perhaps even a large army, who demand to be paid. Here's a very simple solution. Buy some beer, order a pizza, or whatever an appropriate national dish might be, and begin running the printing presses at the National Mint. As soon as the ink is dry in your new pesos, or rubles, or dollars, use them to pay your government workers and soldiers. Alas, you've taxed the people of your country indirectly. You have not physically taken money from their wallets. Instead, you've done it by devaluing the money that stays in their wallets. The Continental Congress did it during the Revolutionary War. Both sides did it during the Civil War. The German government did it between the wars. Countries like Zimbabwe are doing it now. A government does not have to be on the brink of catastrophe to play the inflation card. Even in present-day America, clever politicians can use moderate inflation to their benefit. One feature of irresponsible monetary policy, like a party headed out of control, is that it can be fun for a while. In the short run, easy money makes everyone feel richer. When consumers flock to the Chrysler dealership in Des Moines, the owner's first reaction is that he's doing a really good job of selling cars. Or perhaps he thinks that Chrysler's new models are more attractive than the Fords and Toyotas. In either case, he raises prices, earns more income, and generally believes that his life is getting better. Only gradually does he realize that most other businesses are experiencing the same phenomenon. Since they're raising prices too, his higher income will be lost to inflation. By then, the politicians may have gotten what they wanted, re-election. A central bank that's not sufficiently insulated from politics can throw a wild party before the votes are cast. There'll be lots of dancing on the tables. By the time voters become sick with an inflation-induced hangover, the election is over. Macroeconomic lore has it that Fed Chairman Arthur Burns did such a favor for Richard Nixon in 1972, and that the Bush family is still angry with Alan Greenspan for not adding a little more alcohol to the punch before the 1992 election, when George H.W. Bush was turned out of office following a mild recession. Political independence is crucial if monetary authorities are to do their jobs responsibly. Evidence shows that countries with independent central banks, those that can operate relatively free of political meddling, have lower average inflation rates over time. America's Federal Reserve is among those considered to be relatively independent. Members of its Board of Governors are appointed to 14-year terms by the President. That does not give them the same lifetime tenure as Supreme Court justices, but it does make it unlikely that any new president could pack the Federal Reserve with cronies. It's notable, and even a source of criticism, that the most important economic post in a democratic government is appointed, not elected. We designed it that way. We've made a democratic decision to create a relatively undemocratic institution. A central bank's effectiveness depends on its independence and credibility, almost to the point that a reputation could become self-fulfilling. If firms believe that a central bank will not tolerate inflation, then they'll not feel compelled to raise prices. And if firms do not raise prices, then there will not be an inflation problem. Fed officials are prickly about political meddling. In the spring of 1993, I had dinner with Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve. Mr. Volcker was teaching at Princeton, and he was kind enough to take his students to dinner. President Clinton had just given a major address to a joint session of Congress, and Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, Volcker's successor, had been seated next to Hillary Clinton. What I remember most about the dinner was Mr. Volcker grumbling that it was inappropriate for Alan Greenspan to have been seated next to the president's wife. He felt that it sent the wrong message about the Federal Reserve's independence from the executive branch. That is how seriously central bankers take their political independence. Inflation is bad. Deflation, or steadily falling prices, is much worse. Even modest deflation can be economically devastating, as Japan has learned over the past two decades. It may seem counterintuitive that falling prices could make consumers worse off, especially if rising prices make them worse off too. But deflation begets a dangerous economic cycle. To begin with, falling prices cause consumers to postpone purchases. Why buy a refrigerator today when it will cost less next week? Meanwhile, asset prices also are falling, so consumers feel poorer and less inclined to spend. This is why the bursting of a real estate bubble causes so much economic damage. Consumers watch the value of their homes drop sharply, while their mortgage payments stay the same. They feel poorer because they are. As we know from the last chapter, when consumers spend less, the economy grows less. Firms respond to this slowdown by cutting prices further still. The result is an economic death spiral, as Paul Krugman has noted. Prices are falling because the economy is depressed. Now we've just learned that the economy is depressed because prices are falling. That sets the stage for the return of another monster we haven't seen since the 1930s, a deflationary spiral, in which falling prices and a slumping economy feed on each other, plunging the economy into the abyss. This spiral can poison the financial system, even when bankers are not doing irresponsible things. Banks and other financial institutions get weaker as loans go bad and the value of the real estate and other assets used as collateral for those loans falls. Some banks begin to have solvency problems. Others just have less capital for making new loans, which deprives otherwise healthy firms of credit and spreads the economic distress. The purpose of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, intervention at the end of the George W. Bush administration, the so-called Wall Street bailout, was to recapitalize America's banks and put them back in a position to provide capital to the economy. The design of the program had its flaws. Communication about what the administration was doing and why they were doing it was abysmal. But the underlying concept made a lot of sense in the face of the financial crisis. Monetary policy alone may not be able to break a deflationary spiral. In Japan, the central bank cut nominal interest rates to near zero a long time ago, which means that they can't go any lower. Nominal interest rates can't be negative. Any bank that loaned out $100 and asked for only $98 back would be better off just keeping the $100 in the first place. Okay, that's not exactly true. At the height of the financial crisis, right around the time that Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy, the yield on 3-month U.S. Treasury notes fell below zero, which means that the nominal interest rate had turned negative. Remarkably, investors were paying more for something than it promised to pay them back in 3 months. For policymakers, this was a sign of panic. Keith Hennessy, director of the National Economic Council in the White House, told James Stewart of The New Yorker, "Treasury rates went negative. People were locking in a loss just to protect their money." Yet even with nominal rates near zero, the rental rate on capital, the real interest rate, might actually be quite high. Here's why. If prices are falling, then borrowing $100 today and paying back $100 next year is not costless. The $100 you pay back has more purchasing power than the $100 you borrowed, perhaps much more. The faster prices are falling, the higher your real cost of borrowing. If the nominal interest rate is zero, but prices are falling 5% a year, then the real interest rate is 5%, a cost of borrowing that's too steep when the economy is stagnant. Economists have long been convinced that what Japan needs is a stiff dose of inflation to fix all this. One very prominent economist went so far as to encourage the Bank of Japan to do anything short of dropping banknotes out of helicopters. To hark back to the politics of organized interests covered in Chapter 8, One theory for why Japanese officials have not done more to fight falling prices is that Japan's aging population, many of whom live on fixed incomes or savings, see deflation as a good thing, despite its dire consequences for the economy as a whole. The United States has had its own encounters with deflation. There's a consensus among economists that botched monetary policy was at the heart of the Great Depression. From 1929 to 1933, America's money supply fell by 28%. The Fed did not deliberately turn off the credit tap. Rather, it stood idly by as the money supply fell of its own volition. The process by which money is circulated throughout the economy had become unhitched. Because of widespread bank failures in 1930, both banks and individuals began to hoard cash. Money that was stuffed under a mattress or locked in a bank vault could not be loaned back into the economy. The Fed did nothing while America's credit dried up, and actually raised interest rates sharply in 1931 to defend the gold standard. Fed officials should have been doing just the opposite, pumping money into the system. In September 2009, the one-year anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, Christina Romer, gave a talk ominously entitled Back from the Brink, which laid much of the credit for our escape from economic disaster at the door of the Federal Reserve. She explained, "The policy response in the current episode, in contrast to the 1930s, has been swift and bold. The Federal Reserve's creative and aggressive actions last fall to maintain lending will go down as a high point in central bank history. As credit market after credit market froze or evaporated, the Federal Reserve created many new programs to fill the gap and maintain the flow of credit. Did we drop cash out of helicopters? Almost. It turns out that the Princeton professor who advocated the strategy, not literally, a decade ago for Japan, was none other than Ben Bernanke, earning him the nickname Helicopter Ben in some quarters. Beginning with the first glimmers of trouble in 2007, the Fed used all its conventional tools aggressively, cutting the target federal funds rate 7 times between September 2007 and April 2008. When that began to feel like pushing on a wet noodle, the Fed started to do things that one recent economic paper described as not in the current textbook descriptions of monetary policy. The Fed is America's lender of last resort, making it responsible for the smooth functioning of the financial system, particularly when that system's at risk of seizing up for lack of credit and liquidity. In that capacity, the Fed is vested with awesome powers. Article 13, Part 3 of the Federal Reserve Act gives the Fed authority to make loans to any individual, partnership, or corporation, provided that the borrower is unable to obtain credit from a banking institution. Ben Bernanke can create $500 and loan it to your grandmother to fix the roof, if the local bank has said no and he decides that it might do some good for the rest of us. Bernanke and crew pulled out the monetary policy equivalent of duct tape. The Federal Reserve urged commercial banks to borrow directly from the Fed via the discount window, gave banks the ability to borrow anonymously so that it would not send signals of weakness to the market, and offered longer-term loans. The Fed also loaned funds directly to an investment bank, Bear Stearns, for the first time ever. When Bear Stearns ultimately faced insolvency, the Fed loaned J.P. Morgan Chase $30 billion to take over Bear Stearns, sparing the market from the chaos that later followed the Lehman bankruptcy. In cases where institutions already had access to Fed capital, the rules for collateral were changed so that the borrowers could pledge illiquid assets like mortgage-backed securities, meaning that when Grandma asked for her $500 loan, she could pledge all that stuff in the attic as collateral, even if it was not obvious who would want to buy it or at what price. That gets money to your grandma to fix the roof which was the point of all this. Monetary policy is tricky business. Done right, it facilitates economic growth and cushions the economy from shocks that might otherwise wreak havoc. Done wrong, it can cause pain and misery. Is it possible that all the recent unconventional actions of the Federal Reserve have merely set the stage for another set of problems? Absolutely. It's more likely, at least based on evidence so far, that the Fed averted a more serious crisis and spared a great deal of human suffering as a result. President Barack Obama appointed Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke to a second four-year term beginning in 2010. At the ceremony, the president said, "As an expert on the causes of the Great Depression, I'm sure Ben never imagined that he would be part of a team responsible for preventing another. But because of his background, his temperament, his courage, and his creativity, that's exactly what he has helped to achieve." That's high praise. For now, it seems largely accurate. Chapter 11. International Economics. How did a nice country like Iceland go bust? In 1992, George Soros made nearly $1 billion in a single day for the investment funds he managed. Most people need several weeks to make $1 billion, or even a month. Soros made his billion on a single day in October by making a huge bet on the future value of the British pound relative to other currencies. He was right, making him arguably the most famous currency speculator ever. How did he do it? In 1992, Britain was part of the European Exchange Rate Mechanism, or ERM. This agreement was designed to manage large fluctuations in the exchange rates between European nations. Firms found it more difficult to do business across the continent when they could not predict what the future exchange rates would likely be among Europe's multiple currencies. A single currency, the euro, would come roughly a decade later. The ERM created targets for the exchange rates among the participating countries. Each government was obligated to pursue policies that kept its currency trading on international currency markets within a narrow band around this target. For example, the British pound was pegged to 2.95 German marks and could not fall below a floor of 2.778 marks. Britain was in the midst of a recession, and its currency was falling in value as international investors sold the pound and looked for more profitable opportunities elsewhere in the world. Currencies are no different than any other good. The exchange rate, or the price of one currency relative to another, is determined by supply relative to demand. As the demand for pounds fell, so did the value of the pound on currency markets. The British government vowed that it would defend the pound to keep it from falling below its designated value in the ERM. Soros didn't believe it. And that was what motivated his big bet. The British government had two tools for propping up the value of the pound in the face of market pressure pushing it down. One, the government could use its reserves of other foreign currencies to buy pounds, directly boosting demand for the currency. Or two, the government could use monetary policy to raise real interest rates, which, all else equal, makes British bonds, and the pounds necessary to buy them, more lucrative to global investors and attracts capital, or keeps it from leaving. But the Brits had problems. The government had already spent huge sums of money buying pounds. The Bank of England, the British central bank, risked squandering additional foreign currency reserves to no better effect. Raising interest rates was not an attractive option for the government either. The British economy was in bad shape. Raising interest rates during a recession slows the economy even further, which makes for bad economics and even worse politics. Forbes explained in a post-mortem of the Soros strategy, as Britain and Italy, with similar problems, struggled to make their currencies attractive, they were forced to maintain high interest rates to attract foreign investment dollars. But this crimped their ability to stimulate their sagging economies. Nonetheless, Prime Minister John Major declared emphatically that his overriding objective was to defend the pound's targeted value in the ERM, even as that task seemed ever more difficult. Soros called the government's bluff. He bet that the Brits would eventually give up trying to defend the pound, at which point its value would fall sharply. The mechanics of his billion-dollar day are complex. Soros borrowed a huge sum in British pounds and immediately traded them for stronger currencies, such as the German Deutschmark. When the Brits eventually dropped out of the ERM and devalued the pound, he swapped his currency holdings back for more pounds than he'd originally borrowed. He paid back his loans and kept the difference. Numbers make this all more intuitive. Suppose Soros borrowed 10 billion pounds and swapped them immediately for 10 billion Deutschmarks. The exchange rates and amounts are contrived to make the numbers easier. When the pound was devalued, its value fell by more than 10%, so that 10 billion Deutschmarks subsequently bought 11 billion pounds. Soros swapped his 10 billion Deutschmarks for 11 billion pounds. He paid back his 10 billion pound loan and kept the tidy balance for himself, or more accurately, for his investment funds. Soros supplemented his currency gains with ancillary bets related to how the devaluation would affect European stocks and bonds. But the essence is straightforward. Soros bet heavily that the value of the pound would fall, and he was right. On September 16, 2002, Black Wednesday, Britain withdrew from the ERM, and the pound immediately lost more than 10% of its value. The pound's loss was Soros's gain, big time. International economics shouldn't be any different than economics within countries. National borders are political demarcations, not economic ones. Transactions across national borders must still make all parties better off, or else we wouldn't do them. You buy a Toyota because you think it's a good car at a good price. Toyota sells it to you because they can make a profit. Capital flows across international borders for the same reason it flows anywhere else. Investors are seeking the highest possible return for any given level of risk. Individuals, firms, and governments borrow funds from abroad because it's the cheapest way to rent capital that's necessary to make important investments or to pay the bills. Everything I've just described could be Illinois and Indiana, rather than China and the United States. However, international transactions have added another layer of complexity. Different countries have different currencies. They also have different institutions for creating and managing those currencies. The Fed can create American dollars. It can't do much with Mexican pesos. You buy your Toyota in dollars. Toyota must pay its Japanese workers and executives in yen. And that's where things begin to get interesting. The American dollar is just a piece of paper. It's not backed by gold or rice or tennis balls or anything else with intrinsic value. The Japanese yen is exactly the same. So are the euro, the peso, the rupee, and every other modern currency. When individuals and firms begin trading across national borders, currencies must be exchanged at some rate. If the American dollar is just a piece of paper, and the Japanese yen is just a piece of paper, then how much American paper should we swap for Japanese paper? The rate at which one currency can be exchanged for another is the exchange rate. We have a logical starting point for evaluating the relative value of different currencies. A Japanese yen has value because it can be used to purchase things. A dollar has value for the same reason. So in theory, we ought to be willing to exchange $1 for however many yen or pesos or rubles would purchase roughly the same amount of stuff in the relevant country. If a bundle of everyday goods cost $25 in the United States, and a comparable bundle of goods cost 750 rubles in Russia, then we would expect $25 to be worth roughly 750 rubles, and $1 should be worth roughly 30 rubles. This is the theory of purchasing power parity, or PPP. By the same logic, if the value of the ruble is losing 10% of its purchasing power within Russia every year, while the U.S. dollar is holding its value, we'd expect the ruble to lose value relative to the U.S. dollar, or depreciate at the same rate. This isn't advanced math. If one currency buys less stuff than it used to, then anyone trading for that currency is going to demand more of it to compensate for the diminished purchasing power. Economists make a distinction between the nominal exchange rate, which is the official rate at which one currency can be exchanged for another, the numbers posted on the board of the currency exchange, and the real exchange rate, which takes inflation into account in both countries and is therefore a better indicator of changes in purchasing power of one currency relative to another. For example, assume that the U.S. dollar can be exchanged at your local bank for 10 pesos. Further assume that 1. Inflation is 0 in the United States and 10% annually in Mexico. And 2. A year later, your local bank will exchange $1 for 11 pesos. In nominal terms, the U.S. dollar has appreciated 10% relative to the peso. Each dollar buys 10% more pesos. But the real exchange rate hasn't changed at all. You'll get 10% more pesos at the currency exchange window than you did last year. But because of inflation over the course of the year, each peso now buys 10% less than it used to. As a result, the total purchasing power of the pesos that you get from the bank teller this year for your $100 is exactly the same as the purchasing power of the fewer pesos you got for your $100 last year. Any reference to exchange rates in the balance of this chapter refers to real exchange rates. I learned this lesson once, the hard way. I arrived in Guangzhou, China, in the spring of 1989. By train from Hong Kong. At the time, the Chinese government demanded that tourists exchange dollars for renminbi at ridiculous official rates that had no connection to the relative purchasing powers of the two currencies. For a better deal, backpackers typically exchanged money on the black market. I had studied my guidebook, so when I arrived at the station in Guangzhou, I knew roughly what the black market rate for dollars ought to be, subject to the usual bargaining. I found a currency trader right away and made an opening hardball offer, which the trader accepted immediately. He didn't even quibble, let alone bargain. It turned out that my guidebook was old. The Chinese currency had been steadily losing value ever since publication. I had swapped my $100 for the Chinese equivalent of about $13.50. Purchasing power parity is a helpful concept. It's the tool used by official agencies to make comparisons across countries. For example, when the CIA or the United Nations gathers data on per capita income in other countries and converts that figure into dollars, they often use PPP, as it presents the most accurate snapshot of a nation's standard of living. If someone earns 10,000 Jordanian dinars a year, how many dollars would a person need in the United States to achieve a comparable standard of living? In the long run, the basic economic logic suggests that exchange rates should roughly align with purchasing power parity. If $100 can be exchanged for enough pesos to buy significantly more stuff in Mexico, who'd want the $100? Many of us would trade our dollars for pesos so that we could buy extra goods and services in Mexico and live better. Or, more likely, Clever entrepreneurs would take advantage of the exchange rate to buy cheap goods in Mexico and import them to the United States for a profit. In either case, the demand for pesos would increase relative to dollars, and so would their price, which is the exchange rate. The prices of Mexican goods might rise too. In theory, rational people would continue to sell dollars for pesos until there was no longer any economic advantage in doing so. At that point, $100 in the United States would buy roughly the same goods and services as $100 worth of pesos in Mexico, which is also the point at which the exchange rate would reach purchasing power parity. Here's the strange thing. Official exchange rates, the rate at which you can actually trade one currency for another, deviate widely and for long stretches from what PPP would predict. If purchasing power parity makes economic sense, why is it often a poor predictor of exchange rates in practice? The answer lies in the crucial distinction between goods and services that are tradable, meaning that they can be traded internationally, and those that are not tradable, which are, logically enough, called non-tradable. Televisions and cars are tradable goods. Haircuts and child care are not. In that light, let's revisit our dollar-peso example. Suppose that, at the official peso-dollar exchange rate, a Sony television costs half as much in Tijuana as it does in San Diego. A clever entrepreneur can swap dollars for pesos, buy cheap Sony televisions in Mexico, and then sell them for a profit back in the United States. If he did this on a big enough scale, the value of the peso would climb, and probably the price of televisions in Mexico, moving the official exchange rate in the direction that PPP predicts. Our clever entrepreneur would have a hard time doing the same thing with haircuts, or trash removal, or babysitting, or rental housing. In a modern economy, more than three-quarters of goods and services are non-tradable. A typical basket of goods, the source of comparison for purchasing power parity, contains both tradable and non-tradable goods. If the official exchange rate makes a non-tradable good or service particularly cheap in some country, for example, you can buy a meal in Mumbai for $5 that would cost $50 in Manhattan, there's nothing an entrepreneur can do to exploit this price difference, so it will persist. Using the same Mumbai meal example, you should recognize why PPP is the most accurate mechanism for comparing incomes across countries. At official exchange rates, a Mumbai salary may look very low when converted to dollars, but because many non-tradable goods and services are much less expensive in Mumbai than in the United States, a seemingly low salary may buy a much higher standard of living than the official exchange rate would suggest. Currencies that buy more than PPP would predict are said to be overvalued. Currencies that buy less are undervalued. The Economist created a tongue-in-cheek tool called the Big Mac Index for evaluating official exchange rates relative to what PPP would predict. The McDonald's Big Mac is sold around the world. It contains some tradable components, beef and the condiments, and lots of non-tradables, local labor, rent, taxes, etc. The Economist explains, in the long run, countries' exchange rates should move towards rates that would equalize the prices of an identical basket of goods and services. Our basket is a McDonald's Big Mac, produced in 120 countries. The Big Mac PPP is the exchange rate that would leave hamburgers costing the same in America as elsewhere. Comparing these with actual rates signals if a currency is under or overvalued. In July 2009, a Big Mac cost an average of $3.57 in the United States and 12.5 renminbi in China, suggesting that $3.57 should be worth roughly 12.5 renminbi and $1 worth 3.5 renminbi. But that wasn't even close to the official exchange rate. At the bank, $1 bought 6.83 renminbi, making the renminbi massively undervalued relative to what Bergernomics would predict. Conversely, the dollar is overvalued by the same measure. This is not a freak occurrence. The Chinese government has promoted economic policies that rely heavily on a cheap currency. Of late, the value of the renminbi relative to the dollar has been a significant source of tension between the United States and China, a topic we'll come back to later in this chapter. Exchange rates can deviate quite sharply from what PPP would predict. That invites two additional questions. Why, and so what? Let's deal with the second question first. Imagine checking into your favorite hotel in Paris, only to discover that the rooms are nearly twice as expensive as they were when you last visited. When you protest to the manager, he replies that the room rates have not changed in several years, and he's telling the truth. What has changed is the exchange rate between the euro and the dollar. The dollar has weakened or depreciated against the euro, meaning that each of your dollars buys fewer euros than it did the last time you were in France. The euro, on the other hand, has appreciated. To you, that makes the hotel more expensive. To someone visiting Paris from elsewhere in France, the hotel is the same price as it's always been. A change in the exchange rate makes foreign goods cheaper or more expensive, depending on the direction of the change. That's the crucial point here. If the U.S. dollar is weak, meaning that it can be exchanged for fewer yen or euros than normal, then foreign goods become more expensive. What's true for the Paris hotel is also true for Gucci handbags and Toyota trucks. The price in euros or yen hasn't changed, but that price costs Americans more dollars, which is what they care about. At the same time, a weak dollar makes American goods less expensive for the rest of the world. Suppose Ford decides to price the Taurus at $25,000 in the United States and the local currency equivalent at official exchange rates in foreign markets. If the euro has grown stronger relative to the dollar, meaning that every euro buys more dollars than it used to, then the Taurus becomes cheaper for Parisian car buyers. But Ford still brings home $25,000. It's the best of all worlds for American exporters. Cheaper prices, but not lower profits. The good news for Ford doesn't end there. A weak dollar makes imports more expensive for Americans. A car priced at 25,000 euros used to cost $25,000 in the United States. Now it costs $31,000. Not because the price of the car has gone up, but because the value of the dollar has fallen. In Toledo, the sticker price jumps on every Toyota and Mercedes, making Fords cheaper by comparison. Or Toyota and Mercedes can hold their prices steady in dollars, avoiding the hassle of re-stickering every car on the lot, but take fewer yen and euros back to Japan and Germany. Either way, Ford gets a competitive boost. In general, a weak currency is good for exporters and punishing for importers. In 1992, when the U.S. dollar was relatively weak, a New York Times story began, "The declining dollar has turned the world's wealthiest economy into the filene's basement of industrial countries." A strong dollar has the opposite effect. In 2001, when the dollar was strong by historical standards, a Wall Street Journal headline proclaimed, "GM official says dollar is too strong for U.S. companies." When the Japanese yen appreciates against the dollar by a single yen, a seemingly tiny amount given that the current exchange rate is $1 to 90 yen, Toyota's annual operating earnings fall by $450 million. There's nothing inherently good or bad about a strong or weak currency relative to what PPP would predict. An undervalued currency promotes exports and therefore the industries that produce them. At the same time, a cheap currency raises the cost of imports, which is bad for consumers. Ironically, a weak currency can also harm exporters by making any imported inputs more expensive. A government that deliberately keeps its currency undervalued is essentially taxing consumers of imports and subsidizing producers of exports. An overvalued currency does the opposite, making imports artificially cheap and exports less competitive with the rest of the world. Currency manipulation is like any other kind of government intervention. It may serve some constructive economic purpose, or it may divert an economy's resources from their most efficient use. Would you support a tax that collected a significant fee on every imported good you bought and used the revenue to mail checks to firms that produce exports? How do governments affect the strength of their currencies? At bottom, currency markets are like any other market. The exchange rate is the function of the demand for some currency relative to the supply. The most important factors affecting the relative demand for currencies are global economic forces. A country with a booming economy will often have a currency that's appreciating. Strong growth presents investment opportunities that attract capital from the rest of the world. To make these local investments, for example, to build a manufacturing plant in Costa Rica or buy Russian stocks, foreign investors must buy the local currency first. The opposite happens when an economy is flagging. Investors take their capital somewhere else, selling the local currency on their way out. All else equal, great demand for a country's exports will cause its currency to appreciate. When global oil prices spike, for example, the Middle East oil producers accumulate huge quantities of dollars. International oil sales are denominated in dollars. When these profits are repatriated to local currency, say back to Saudi Arabia, they cause the Saudi rial to appreciate relative to the dollar. Higher interest rates, which can be affected in the short run by the Federal Reserve in the United States or the equivalent central bank in other countries, make a currency more valuable. All else equal, higher interest rates provide investors with a greater return on capital, which draws funds into a country. Suppose a British pound can be exchanged for $1.50, and the real return on government bonds in both the United Kingdom and the United States is 3%. If the British government uses monetary policy to raise their short-term interest rates to 4%, American investors would be enticed to sell U.S. Treasury bonds and buy British bonds. To do so, of course, they have to use the foreign exchange market to sell dollars and buy pounds. If nothing else changes in the global economy, an unlikely scenario, the increased demand for British pounds would cause the pound to appreciate relative to the dollar. Of course, all else equal is a phrase that never actually applies to the global economy. Economists have an extremely poor record of predicting movements in exchange rates, in part because so many complex global phenomena are affecting the foreign exchange markets at once. For example, the U.S. economy was ground zero for the global recession that began in 2007. With the U.S. economy in such a poor state, one would have expected the dollar to depreciate relative to other major global currencies. In fact, U.S. Treasury bonds are a safe place to park capital during economic turmoil. So, as the financial crisis unfolded, investors from around the world fled to safety in U.S. Treasuries, causing the U.S. dollar to appreciate despite the floundering American economy. Countries can also enter a foreign exchange market directly, buying or selling their currencies in an effort to change their relative value, as the British government tried to do while fighting off the 1992 devaluation. Given the enormous size of the foreign exchange market, with literally trillions of dollars in currencies changing hands every day, most governments don't have deep enough pockets to make much of a difference. As the British government and many others have learned, a currency intervention can feel like trying to warm up a cold bathtub with one spoonful of hot water at a time, particularly while speculators are doing the opposite. As the British government was buying pounds, Soros and others were selling them, effectively dumping cold water in the same tub. We still haven't really answered the basic question at the beginning of the chapter. How many yen should a dollar be worth? Or rubles? Or krona? There are a lot of possible answers to that question, depending in large part on the exchange rate mechanism that a particular country adopts. An array of mechanisms can be used to value currencies against one another. The gold standard. The simplest system to get your mind around is the gold standard. No modern industrialized country uses gold any longer, other than for overpriced commemorative coins. But in the decades following World War II, the gold standard provided a straightforward mechanism for coordinating exchange rates. Countries pegged their currencies to a fixed quantity of gold, and therefore implicitly to each other. It's like one of those grade school math problems. If an ounce of gold is worth $35 in America and 350 francs in France, what is the exchange rate between the dollar and the franc? One advantage of the gold standard is that it provides predictable exchange rates. It also protects against inflation. A government cannot print new money unless it has sufficient gold reserves to back the new currency. Under this system, the paper in your wallet does have intrinsic value. You can take your $35 and demand an ounce of gold instead. The gold standard has a nice ring to it. However, the system made for catastrophic monetary policy during the Great Depression and can seriously impair monetary policy even during normal circumstances. When a currency backed by gold comes under pressure, for example, because of a weakening economy, foreigners start to demand gold instead of paper. In order to defend the nation's gold reserves, the central bank must raise interest rates, even though a weakening economy needs the opposite. Economist Paul Krugman, who earned a Nobel Prize in 2008 for his work on international trade, explained recently, "In the early 1930s, this mentality led governments to raise interest rates and slash spending, despite mass unemployment, in an attempt to defend their gold reserves. And even when countries went off gold, the prevailing mentality made them reluctant to cut rates and create jobs. If the United States had been on the gold standard in 2007, the Fed would have been largely powerless to ward off the crisis. Under the gold standard, a central bank can always devalue the currency. For example, declare that an ounce of gold buys more dollars than it used to. But that essentially defeats the purpose of having a gold standard in the first place." In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt ended the right of individual Americans to exchange cash for gold. But nations retained that right when making international settlements. In 1971, Richard Nixon ended that too. Inflation in the United States was making the dollar less desirable. Given a choice between $35 and an ounce of gold, foreign governments were increasingly demanding the gold. After a weekend of deliberation at Camp David, Nixon unilaterally closed the gold window. Foreign governments could redeem gold for dollars on Friday, but not on Monday. Since then, the United States and all other industrialized nations have operated with fiat money, which is a fancy way of saying that those dollars are just paper. Floating exchange rates. The gold standard fixes currencies against one another. Floating rates allow them to fluctuate as economic conditions dictate, even minute by minute. Most developed economies have floating exchange rates. Currencies are traded on foreign exchange markets, just like a stock exchange or eBay. At any given time, the exchange rate between the dollar and yen, reflects the price at which parties are willing to voluntarily trade one for the other, just like the market price of anything else. When Toyota makes loads of dollars selling cars in the United States, they trade them for yen with some party that's looking to do the opposite. Or Toyota can use the dollars to pay American workers, make investments inside the United States, or buy American inputs. With floating exchange rates, governments have no obligation to maintain a certain value of their currency, as they do under the gold standard. The primary drawback of this system is that currency fluctuations create an added layer of uncertainty for firms doing international business. Ford may make huge profits in Europe only to lose money in the foreign exchange markets when it tries to bring the euros back home. So far, exchange rate volatility has proven to be a drawback of floating rates, though not a fatal flaw. International companies can use the financial markets to hedge their currency risk. For example, an American firm doing business in Europe can enter into a futures contract that locks in some euro-dollar exchange rate at a specified future date, just as Southwest Airlines might lock in future fuel prices, or Starbucks might use the futures market to protect against an unexpected surge in the price of coffee beans. Fixed exchange rates, or currency bands. Fixed or pegged exchange rates are a lot like the gold standard, except that there's no gold. This may seem like a problem, and it often is. Countries pledge to maintain their exchange rates at some predetermined rate with a group of other countries, such as the nations of Europe. The relevant currencies trade freely on markets, but each participating government agrees to implement policies to keep its currency trading within the predetermined range. The European exchange rate mechanism, described at the beginning of this chapter, was such a system. The primary problem with a peg is that countries can't credibly commit to defending their currencies. When a currency begins to look weak, as the pound did, then speculators pounce, hoping to make millions or billions if the currency is devalued. Of course, when speculators and others concerned about devaluation aggressively sell the local currency, as Soros did, then devaluation becomes all the more likely. Borrowing someone else's strong reputation. At the end of 1990, inflation in Argentina was more than 1,000% a year, to no one's great surprise, given the country's history of hyperinflation. Is that a currency you want to own? Argentina had long been the world's inflation bad boy, the monetary equivalent of someone who stands you up for three straight dates and then tries to tell you that the fourth time will be different. It won't be, and everyone knows it. So, when Argentina finally got serious about fighting inflation, the central bank had to do something radical. Basically, it hired the United States as a chaperone. In 1991, Argentina declared that it was relinquishing control over its own monetary policy. No more printing money. Instead, the government created a currency board with strict rules to ensure that henceforth every Argentine peso would be worth one U.S. dollar. To make that possible, and credible to the world, the currency board would guarantee that every peso in circulation would be backed by one U.S. dollar held in reserve. Thus, the currency board would be allowed to issue new pesos only if it had new dollars in its vaults to back them up. Moreover, every Argentine peso would be convertible on demand for a U.S. dollar. In effect, Argentina created a gold standard with the U.S. dollar substituting for the gold. It worked for a while. Inflation plummeted to double digits and then to single digits. Alas, there was a huge cost. Remember all those wonderful things the Fed chairman can do to fine-tune the economy? The Argentine government could not do any of them. It had abdicated control over the money supply in the name of fighting inflation. Nor did Argentina have any independent control over its exchange rate. The pay